If he's doing conventional moon bounce, conventional meaning you transmit a signal to the moon by Morse code, single sideband, or whatever, usually with an antenna that has close to 400 square feet of area. On 432, conventional moon bounce required 16 possible well-tuned Yagis mounted on a great big bedspring. That, combined with your kilowatt transmitter, gave you close to 500,000 watts of effective radiated power. You aim that at the moon. The moon and the signal coming back from the moon on 432 has got 263 decibels of loss. So a minuscule pipsqueak of a signal comes back. You gather as much of it as you can with that great big antenna, a low noise preamplifier, or less than 1 dB noise figure preamplifier, and with a set of earphones, you listen to that very, very weak signal in the noise, and you make contact. That's the way it's conventionally done. Lots of power, lots of antenna. Along comes the Joe Taylor techniques, K1JT, the weak signal WSJT techniques. Let me drop. And now, instead of the human set of ears listening for that weak tone in the noise, which requires something close to 0 dB of signal-to-noise ratio, the digital techniques of the WSJT allow you to listen to a signal that is 28 decibels weaker than the noise, and it will get a medium probability copy signal on the screen and type it out for you. With the WSJT system, guys with one simple Yagi on 2 meters at 100 watts of power have fairly reliably done moon bounce. Now, can one long Yagi on 1.2 gigs, can it do it with 20 watts? My gut feel is it's marginal. However, I'm trying to think of what website we can go to. I know that the K2UIH, K2 Uniform Yankee Hotel, that is Dr. Alan Katz, who for 30 years continuously, maybe it's 35 years, has been publishing something called the 432 and above EME News. In that newsletter, you'll eventually find, if you go to the right one, and there's a website that allow you to look at all of those past issues. You go to that website of K2UIH, you look at those past issues, you'll find out exactly what each of those guys have used. There's about, let me pick a number, 500, 300, something in that order. Let me drop. Something between 300 and 500 guys worldwide who have done moon bounce on the various bands from 50 megacycles up to at least 24 gigahertz. They've done moon bounce on all of those frequencies. And the 432 and above EME newsletter, a essentially monthly journal, is a beautifully done thing by Dr. Katz of Trenton College, where he gives you a report every single month about what each one of these guys are doing, who they've talked to, what equipment they've used, schematic diagrams, pictures of their antennas, and so on. So there you will find exactly what everyone has done. You read the right issues of the EME News, you'll find out what is the weakest amount of power, what is the smallest amount of antenna on each one of those bands, each one of those guys have used for moon bounce. There you're going to the horse's mouth, if you know what I mean. You're getting the information from the people who are doing it. You can't get any better than that. So that's the best resource. I'm going to try to find that website for you for the EME News. Once you find it, that's going to give you questions and answers like you wouldn't believe. If you're interested in moon bounce, those are the people. Once every 2 years, they hold a national convention, United States, England, Germany, whatever. They hold it in some particular place, and 150 of these guys from about 30 countries all get together, and they compare war stories as to what they've done, how much the wind has damaged their antennas, how much they put up with the local zoning boards that set up their antennas to do this and whatever. Interesting group of people. A subculture like you wouldn't believe. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the ZECNET.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, Earth, Moon, Earth, I guess that EME, right? My personal feeling is, I think if he's below 50 watts, he's in trouble. If he gets up above that, I think he might have a shot at it. But more antennas and more altitude, and maybe some software might get him going, but well, at least he's got a project to do, and we'll see if we can get that email for him, that site for him. And I do have one question, which I'll save for after, for later. It's a little involved. And we'll get Paul done, and we'll take it from there. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
I hope Paul's available, and if so, while Paul is doing his presentation, I'll be looking for that website by which you can get to K2UIH's EME News. There's a website that has an archive of all of the past issues for 30 solid years. And some of these are beautiful productions. These are essentially a magazine that's published by a website, if you know what I mean. Beautiful color pictures, diagrams, schematics, reports of individual guys. What has happened in EME, Earth, Moon, or Moon Balance Communication, on any of the roughly 432 and above bands, and 2 meters is included in there, what those guys have done for the last month is in the last issue, if you know what I mean. And you can get information that's as current as you can get as to what is the state-of-the-art, what feed horn designs they're using, what low-noise amplifier designs they're using, how many watts, what frequency, what protocol they're using, what frequencies they transmit on and listen on, depending on what day of the week and whatever, and what contest is going on, the moon bounce contest. There's one human being per 500 in the general population as a ham radio operator. When it comes to things like moon bounce operators and Sirius microwave operators, there's roughly one of them per 500 hams. So we're talking about one per quarter of a million people in the general population are doing this. You can see why I call it a subculture. These are rare birds, but boy, are they enthusiastic. That's why they've got this journal that keeps them all together, and they've got a couple of websites where they keep reporting to each other continuously what they're doing and how they're doing it and how well it's working. Okay, let's see if Paul's available. WS2N, a space expert. What's NASA doing? K2RIW in the TechNet. If you're there, you got it, Paul. Yeah, I didn't hear Paul sign in earlier, so he might not be available tonight. If he signs in a little bit later, we'll pick him up when he does. John, it looks like it's time for your deeper question. Take your time and give us all the details. And don't skip anything. I'm having some fun with you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Dick, why don't we check to make sure there's nobody else before we go any further? Maybe somebody else wants to check in or has another question.
Good idea. Do we have any late check-ins with questions? Give us your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WHCDL Mobile. I just turned it on. I can't stay. So maybe we'll hold off on the magnetron question until next week. Because I won't be able to stay very long. I'm just getting home now. I'm on the road. And it'll be not fair if I just pose the question for a discussion and then not be there. So we'll hold off on that, but I didn't forget. I wanted to let you know. Go ahead.
I've got a good idea. Who is that?
K4NBC. I got a question for you, too.
Okay. Andy, he's on the way home. He can pose the question to us. And even though you're going to arrive home, and as you go from the car to the house, if you don't have a handy talkie you can carry with you, you'll get the, 1 minute's worth of interruption on what you hear. But still, that could be a coherent question that Andy asks. I'm going to give Andy that option. While he's thinking about that, let's pick up Bob, K4 National Broadcasting Company from Florida, the place where we're going to retire to. Go right ahead with your question, Bob. K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, Dick. I'm building a satellite receiver for my repeater. Actually that term there. using a remote receiver that will be RF linked. And I'm using a pair of walkie-talkies to do it, somewhat modified. And I don't like the audio response I get from 8 ohms going into the microphone circuit. So the other radio. So if you were doing this, would you use a resistor divider network, or would you use a transformer and capacitors?
Yeah, the microphone circuit that's on handy talkies is a very exotic thing. It's a so-called electret microphone. It's a little bit of a crystal material that has, in its day of manufacture, been biased with a high voltage. In other words, as you manufacture that crystal, while the crystal is curing, you continuously expose it to a high voltage. You polarize the crystal in such a way that it generates a small voltage, and now that electret crystal, when it's being flexed by the diaphragm, so to speak, the tiny little diaphragm, it presents an audio signal that the input circuitry of the handy talkie operates on. So that very simple looking microphone, it's got a lot of sophistication in there. And so how you couple the audio into a handy talkie, if you're not using its built-in microphone, is a little bit of a problem. You may have to study the schematic diagram. May have to go one stage downrange, because that electret generates its own voltage, which is part of the biasing network for that first transistor. And if you just put a transformer there and you short it out, that first transistor is not being biased in the way it was designed. As you can tell, it's very easy to disturb that circuit. You may have to plug in your audio one transistor stage downrange in that audio network in order to properly feed that. So there's an art and science to the way that microphone circuit works. That's what you're running into, in my guess, Bob. So it's going to take a little bit more study. Do you make it a higher impedance, a lower voltage, whatever? Do you allow it to be capacitively coupled so it can develop the right amount of bias? Ordinarily, the electret element itself generates some DC bias. It's a passive circuit that, when it's looking into megohms, will generate some DC voltage that properly biases that transistor. And when you just bypass that
repeater, timeout, cancel.
When you simply bypass that microphone and plug in audio there, you can very easily disturb that circuit's original function, if you know what I mean. So it's going to take some more study on that one. So you're fighting the electret substitution problem. Many of us own a separate speaker mic, and when we use a separate speaker mic, sometimes it doesn't do a good job, even though it's designed by the company. You'd be amazed how many times a person will use an external speaker mic, and now his audio is usually much too low because it's not using that circuit in the original intended manner when he uses that. Even though it's an ICOM design speaker mic being plugged into the right ICOM rig, there is a certain percentage of people, when they use an external speaker mic, are not happy with the response they get. So that's part of what you're up against there, Bob. It's going to take a little more study. And when you solve the problem, please come back and tell us the solution. Because right now, I don't know of anybody's article that tells us how to do that. You're blazing a brand new trail here, Bob. Kilo 4, NBC, K2RIW on the TechNet.
N2EO with a suggestion, Vic.
Go ahead with your suggestion first, Rich. N2EO.
Okay, Dick. I haven't actually done it, but I'm thinking in my mind what I would do is transform a couple of it. But I would put it in one side of the transformer. I'd put like a 0.1 mylar capacitor so he doesn't short out the biasing circuit. And then on the far side of the capacitor, he's going to have to figure out how much of a what resistance resistor to put across the what is now the input, you know, to simulate where the electric condenser mic was. What do you think?
KG2, QIQ with a comment?
Okay, we're going to pick up Glenn and Eric in that order. As you can tell, you're getting into a very delicate circuit here. You're doing a kind of very minor brain surgery, if you know what I mean, when you try to make a substitution for that electret. And
could the...
Okay, Okay, Bob apparently wants to stop us from going too much further with this. Go ahead, Bob.
Okay, no, I'm ready for everyone's suggestions. I should have added that I am using the speaker mic connection to the radio from what is supposed to be an 8-ohm audio output. Now, I do have audio. I don't like the frequency response of it. That's the problem that I'm having. The audio is there. I can get feedback 10 feet away, for example, but speech audio is lower. The audio gain is tilted up towards the high end there. So anyway, I just wanted to, you know, add that I am using the external speaker mic connection through a cable that goes to the loudspeaker jack on the back of the radio, or on the radio, with the volume crank almost all the way down. So it works, but I just don't. It works. You can understand everything. There's really no audio distortion, but I just don't like the frequency roll off. Back to you, Dick, and then on to the suggestions from K4NBC in the borough of Florida. And a little bit later, I'll tell you about the parasite that I sort of invented.
Exciting. A parasite is invented for the borough of Florida. Fantastic. Yeah, you're running into some of the problem of people who use an external speaker mic. Quite often, they're unhappy. It works, but it doesn't sound the same. And sometimes you don't even recognize the person. And quite often, it's very mushy-sounding audio. You've got the opposite problem, too shrill high frequencies. And Bob, as you know, has worked for lots of years in television broadcast. As such, he knows what good audio should sound like. And the pride of his engineering background, as such, he wants his rig to have that quality of audio. It's a very good goal to have. A buddy of mine in the Albany area has a very nice repeater, but it's got the mushiest sounding audio in the world, that until you've listened to that repeater for 6 months and learn what people sound like and what their vocabulary is, you're an out-of-the-area person. You go there and you listen to that very mushy audio. You can't understand what the people are saying, even though they're dead full quieting. So good audio is an art form that's definitely worth pursuing. Glenn, how would you solve the problem? Because that's a very delicate circuit. Just the right coupling capacitor and the right bias. It's in the right direction, but to really substitute for the electret microphone. I mean, they got fancy circuitry in there to correct the frequency response of the electret, and somehow you've got to crank that back out. I think Bob might be forced into going one stage down range, one transistor down range, if you know what I mean, and injecting the audio and just simply eliminating that first transistor, which is a very tight marriage between it and the DC bias voltage and all the other characteristics of that electret microphone. Maybe we'll have to just bypass that. KC2QIQ, how would you solve it, Glenn? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I've done this quite a few times, Dick, with very, very good results. And how I did it was, depending on which, driving a low impedance source into a high impedance source. So if I have a low impedance and with a volume control, and you want to get that volume control centered somewhere in the middle to drive the high impedance circuit, what I generally do is use three resistors. And how I would do it is, if the circuit input that I'm going into, let's say, has a 600 ohm input impedance, I would put a 600 ohm resistor directly in parallel with the input, and then use two 600 ohm resistors in series to both the plus and the minus side. So basically what I'm doing is I have the low impedance source being isolated by 600 ohms on the plus side, 600 ohms on the minus side, and then having 600 ohms right across the input. If it's a much higher input, like 10K ohms, into the input, I would normally put 10K ohms in parallel with the input, and then put 10K ohms on the plus side and on the minus side. And then this way, when you adjust the low impedance audio source, typically you can get a nice half or midway scale and have a pretty good resistor divider, giving you fairly good audio response into your high impedance input. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
So if it was has a 600 ohm audio circuit input impedance. You put a 600 ohm resistor in series with it. Then that resistor goes to the junction of another pair of 600 ohms, one going up to plus and one going down to minus. And that, at least, I think you're saying, usually creates the right bias, the right impedance. And is it at that junction that you capacitively couple your audio input? You didn't tell us how the audio gets into that circuit, Glenn. Back to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Comment.
Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn.
Okay, let me explain it again. There's only three resistors there. No capacitors, no nothing else required. If I have a low impedance, let's say there's an audio output with low impedance, it's supposed to drive an 8-ohm speaker, like in this particular case, so that he has a volume control where he's turning up the volume control, and basically he has too large a voltage there. And he wants to go into, let's say, a 10K ohm input impedance. The input to the other device, I would put 10K ohms directly in parallel with the 10K ohm input, and then take a 10K ohm resistor in series with the plus side and a 10K ohm resistor in series with the bottom side, and then run them right back to the speaker connection that would normally be 8 ohms. So now that low impedance speaker-driven circuit has got 10K ohms in series with the plus, 10K ohms in series with the minus, and then those two 10K ohm resistors are tapped right across the 10K ohm resistor directly in parallel with the high impedance 10K ohm input. Does that make more sense to you?
That does. When you said plus and minus, I thought you were talking about power supplies. You were talking about plus and minus leads of the secondary of a transformer that's got the audio on it, for instance. Now it makes a little bit more sense. Okay. So that gives you pretty good impedance match, and it gives you the ability to adjust volume. But in the case of this crazy electret circuit, it also needs just the right DC bias for that circuit to work right. So bypassing the whole first stage or studying a schematic diagram, they did some fancy things to try to match the crazy impedance, the crazy voltages and whatever that the electret element itself produces. Now, Eric was the next person on the list. Eric.
Comment.
Yeah, well, I know you're the third guy in the list. Now, Eric was the second guy in the list with a comment. Eric, how have you solved this problem? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, you know, we in broadcasting use various different kinds of electric. One thing that I will say is that working on the broadcast stuff and working on amateur radio stuff are a little bit different. But the crystal elements themselves, what they use in the ham radio gear, it depends on the manufacturer. Some people use some electric with their base impedance is around 10 megohms. I've seen them at about 500K. And the name of the game to doing this right, you're going to go through that first transistor. You have to duplicate the bias that is created. And what we've done in the past, matching some low impedance audio, we had a couple of applications where we had to use some commercial stuff, you know, like Motorola, for audio for IFB. And what we found was you actually got to measure that voltage and duplicate that bias. Then you can either use a resistive divider network to make the transition between the low impedance to the high impedance, and you need to be able to also make a T network to attenuate the audio down to the level of something like 10 millivolts or 15 millivolts. Now, the other thing about electric linear drop, there's actually a preemphasis circuit that attenuates the high end a little bit, because the electrics themselves produce an awful lot of high frequency energy and not a lot of low frequency energy. And in the broadcast microphones, there's a whole series of networks to invert the shape of that response so that way it comes out flat. So the simplest thing to do is need a very, very high impedance voltmeter to find out what the bias is of that particular circuit, or if you want to look at the actual voltages across the transistors, you've got a schematic, you can figure it out. Then the other thing that you have to do is you have to invert the response of the microphone and the incoming audio that you're matching into it. You have to go through a network that does just that. K2RWK, 3J. And by the way, going and bypassing the transistor is sometimes not easy because you go from a very high impedance to a low impedance, and there's usually a bias voltage there because the transistors are decoupled.
Wow, you said a mouthful. If that input impedance is 10 megohms from the electret microphone end of it, wow. Properly matching that, having the right voltage on this delicate DC-coupled cascode amplifier pair of transistors in the front end that normally connects to the electret, I see something about what you're going through here. When it comes to the broadcast industry, Eric, nowadays almost everybody wears this tiny little lapel microphone that's, and the cable from that is hidden in their clothing, and then goes to a radio transmitter and receiver that hangs on their belt, and it's usually on the backside, so to speak, on the belt of the personality that's on the screen. And some of these headsets that people wear have a tiny little rod that comes out in front of their mouth with the world's smallest microphone. So are those lapel microphones and those tiny little rod microphones on the headset, are those also electrets? And how in the world do they get such beautiful frequency response out of such a tiny thing like that, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Now, first of all, the headset mounted is actually a boom microphone. The thing that you see in front of their mouth is just a little tube. I don't know if you've ever seen a Plantronics headset, but it's just basically that type of configuration. There's a couple of manufacturers. There's Sennheiser, Countryman, Electrosonic. There are a few others. The electric element is actually very, very tiny. And a lot of times you're fixing the damn little wires that come out of this tube. They're not really fragile, but they break every now and then. I'm sure Bob could tell you all about that. That's why on some shows you'll see them wearing two of these little microphones, because just in case one fails. you'd be surprised at the kind of frequency response. A lot of them have a cardioid type pattern, and some of them are pretty darn directional. And that's a good thing, because if you think about it, when you have a group of people sitting around a table, we're all wearing lapels, you're going to be having multiple faders up. And there is a time delay between one person who's talking and the person sitting to the right of them. It takes a moment for the sound to get there. So if his microphone is picking up the other speakers, and you have those two faders turned up, you wind up getting phased, because they're not in phase anymore. So there's a lot of interesting things that go into this, but the frequency responses of those mics are actually electronically tuned out. They go through, many of them have these actually because of the ICs that we have today, they go through a series of op amps that shape the waveform correctly inverted to that particular element. So there's, and a whole series of manufacturers have different methods of doing it too. You'll have people who swear by Sennheiser, other people who swear by Electrosonic, and other people who swear by a few other manufacturers.
Fantastic. Eric, you just brought to our attention another very interesting characteristic that people don't recognize. Sound traveling through air has a velocity of about 1 foot per millisecond. The upper end of the speech region you and I care about is 1 kilohertz. So if I've got two people sitting side by side on Jay Leno's couch and they're 3 feet apart, there's 3 milliseconds of delay between those two people. If we talk about the 1 kc note that the guy is speaking at this instant, the guy to the right is getting my voice, so to speak, 3 cycles down range. And as you move around a little bit, the 3 cycles down range could be in phase or out of phase. So if you don't have enough directivity of those lapel microphones, and if more than one radio that these people are wearing are picking up the audio, now the fading between the two can suck out certain portions of the frequency region and make it sound pretty peculiar. So I think you're telling me that these lapel mics have got a carefully controlled antenna pattern of the audio favoring the mouth of the person that's wearing it, and hopefully giving you a kind of a partial null off to the side so that the adjacent audio is not picked up. Is that approximately the way they're designed, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RWK3J. That's about right. There's actually different types of microphones with different patterns, and it's actually the A2, as they call them, who selects the particular microphone. And there's also differences in microphones between the type of voice that you're working with. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but there are performers that will bring their own microphone that is particularly attuned to their vocal, their lung response, and their voice box responses that give them their pleasing results. So one microphone never serves all, so to speak.
Wow. I can see that. So a person who's really smart enough to know that when he sings and when he talks, that the right kind of a microphone tuned to his voice will give the most pleasing sound. He comes with that microphone, and does he also come with a radio that matches that microphone, or are the microphones themselves made in such a way that the radio the person is wearing on his belt, and it's on the back of him, so to speak, do the microphones always find compatibility, or does he actually have to bring the radio to make sure that everything works just right for him? How does he solve that problem, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Okay, when you go into a live situation with a broadcast station, that's one given thing. Where the actual radios themselves, and when they're set up, and they're pretty darn flat. So they're pretty darn guaranteed to be flat. So if somebody comes with a handheld microphone that's specific to them, we'll actually, there's an XLR connector on the back of it, and we'll actually plug in a Sennheiser transmitter in the back of that. So the responsibility of the RF portion of it really is the station, and depending upon whether you're using Sennheiser, Electrosonic, Shure, there's a few others. There's very little difference between the transmitters and the receivers. Some people tend to like to use the diversity antennas that are mounted in various different places in the studio. I'm one of those wise people that says I don't like those things, and I don't like to see the receiver bouncing back and forth between the two channels. What I tend to do is I use Radiax in my studios, and I've had people come in and say, how do you do that? But the R portion of it is pretty consistent.
Well done. You've got enough radio experience to know what Radiax is. That's the cable that's made by the Andrew Company. It's a kind of hardline cable that's got a whole bunch of periodic holes drilled into the outer copper jacket of the cable, and therefore it is a slightly leaky wave signal. And now when you run Radiax around the building, it is one single distributed antenna with one point of input. It doesn't require a voting system between multiple receivers and multiple antennas to make sure there's no fade spots in that studio as the people walk around. Very smart. Are you one of the very few people using Radiax, Eric? And how come you haven't written some articles into the broadcasting journal so that other people know this smarts? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Now, you got to consider the broadcast industry is somewhat small, and word of mouth travels pretty far, especially amongst audio professionals. There's not that many of them, and there are a lot of people that talk. And I'm not talking about a whole building. I may be talking about a 100-foot by 50-foot studio, or, you know, I'll put two runs. I mean, all of the receivers are diversity. You operate them diversity because there will be no points in various different places. But if you've ever seen in a studio with the separate antennas at the points at the different corners of the studio and watch the video lights on the receiver switch back and forth, it does silently, by the way. You don't hear any disturbance in the audio. That's how good these receivers are. There are times when, you know, somebody walks into the bathroom or something like that, and you'll hear the receiver get noisy. And you'll see the idiot lights going nuts trying to pick up the signal. But there's a lot of people who have experienced what I've done and what we've done in our studios. We're not, you know, it's not exclusively us, so to speak, but and my friends know about it. A lot of people are using it. They like it.
I got a crazy quick question for you. A person who's not electronically informed is wearing a microphone for broadcast purposes and a radio is connected to his belt. He assumes when he walks out of the studio that that microphone is no longer picking him up. He walks into the bathroom. In the bathroom, he's talking to his friend, and he starts revealing some very inside information, and he doesn't realize what he's saying is being broadcast, so to speak, and at least somebody else could be picking it up. I'll bet you there are stories where somebody goes to the bathroom with this microphone on, not realizing that it's live, not realizing people are hearing him, and I'll bet that has created some funny stories. Is that true, Eric? KQRIW?
No. If you go back through the years, there are people who, you know, have their public face, and then they say something very derogatory, and it makes the news. But a lot of times they'll go off the set, do their talking, the tape machine's rolling, and not only is it that someone heard it, but it got recorded too. So that's happened quite a lot. So people are, or at least talent is more conscious about hitting the off switch on the transmitter.
And it takes a lot of skill and prior experience to know to do that. A person, as a personality on a television show for the first time, being equipped with a portable RF microphone for the first time, may not know all of that. And boy, is he vulnerable if somebody doesn't tell him what to be careful about.
Quite a few politicians.
Say that again about the politicians.
Has happened to a few politicians. You go through the news, you'll find there's a whole bunch of stories of various different people with notable names that that's happened to.
I ran into the...
Lost his job thanks to an open mic.
Yeah, that was again, Bob. Who lost his job because of an open mic? Back to you again, Bob.
Sportscaster Jimmy the Greek. Of course, you know, every now and then something makes the news where, you know, an open mic caught something before somebody went on the air and they recorded it and then put it on the air. So one of the things that one of the rules, if you're a broadcaster, you know, or I mean if you're talent, so to speak, is if you see a microphone, it's hot. Consider all microphones hot and keep your mouth shut.
Darn good advice, Bob. So as you solve this problem of the 10 megohm input impedance electret microphone system, very simple looking circuit when you look at it physically, but electronically a hell of a lot's going on. It's got a DC coupled pair of transistors, a cascode-like amplifier in the front end, with just the right bias, just the right impedance match to that crazy microphone. When you solve this problem, Bob, please come back and tell us what the solution is, because I guarantee lots of people have run into this one. In fact, I think some people have gotten around it by saying that, well, I'll just reproduce the audio with a loudspeaker that's close to that microphone and let everything pour acoustically into the handy-talkie. I think people have chosen that solution, because even the speaker mic sometimes... designed by the manufacturer doesn't do a very good job, as you're discovering. Okay, the next person on the list with comments.
I net update, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, to all those who are interested, Bernie has posted the information, so he definitely has it on his website. If people are interested in the deeper discussion, that is available at Bernie Hunt. Website, so they can get that, download the information, to be able to go to all these sites that we'll be talking about if that comes to be. Back to you.
K2L.
There's the man.
Yeah, Bernie, tell us that exact, is it huntfamily.org or .com? Tell us that email address that a person goes to find the website addresses that when we go to the deeper discussion we might be using. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW.
Evening, Dick and the Net. Sorry about the slow update there. My wife wanted to be entertained, so I had to pay attention to family issues. Yes, I got everything is uploaded, so you can view it. If you'd like to join the Dropbox, we're using a feature called Dropbox, which basically is a file sharing service. If you would like to join that, you just need to send me an email, and I'll add you to the list. You can send me the email one of two different ways. If you go to QRZ, my call sign is K2YO, Kilo 2 Yankee Oscar. My email is listed on QRZ, so you can get to me that way. Or you can send it to me directly. Obviously, I'm in the Limark roster, and my direct address is Bernie, B-E-R-N-I-E. It's about 1,000 ways to spell Bernie, but mine is B-E-R-N-I-E at huntfamily.com. My last name is Hunt, H-U-N-T. I am the huntfamily.com, so Bernie at huntfamily.com. Okay there?
That's very good information, Bernie. And you're in the process of setting up the Dropbox, which I think will eventually be part of the limarc.org website, which I'm not quite sure is operational right now. Now, a person who sends an email to you and asks to be added to the Dropbox or to this listserv that you're now creating requires a response from you by which you give them, I think, a password or whatever. Could a person who, for the first time, is hearing the TechNet tonight and goes to Bernie at huntfamily.com, would he be able to, tonight, be able to know the website addresses that possibly are going to be discussed tonight? So without prior notice, could a person cold tonight succeed in getting the information in that many that manner, Bernie? K2IO, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Absolutely, absolutely. Just takes it takes seconds to sign up. You send me just an email saying, hey, put me on it. I put your name on the list, and bang, you've got access. So I apologize that it's a manual process. We got to get Dropbox to make that a little bit somewhat easier some way. But anyway, I tell you what, I'll make a commitment that anybody that can get me an email before 11 o'clock, it's 10:44 at least by my people to watch here. Anybody that gets me their email before 11 o'clock will be on the list and will be able to access it tonight. Does that sound fair enough?
More than fair enough, Bernie. Thank you for this dedication. So a person who gets their email address to Bernie at B-E-R-N-I-E at huntfamily, H-U-N-T, family.com, will be added to the list. Therefore, they'll be able to essentially immediately see the websites that we're going to be discussing if we do use those websites on the technical information, the so-called deeper technical information tonight. The next person on the list who wanted to make a comment about proper microphone connections on the electret microphone of a handy talkie was Wes, N2XJN. Go right ahead, Wes, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I would like to say very much thank you for Eric, Glenn, and you, because you covered excellently the subject. So for me, there is not much to say. Right now, I could go to the general information of it. A condenser, a microphone, eliminates the need for the polarizing power supply, and it's using permanently charged material. So the electric material with the permanently embedded static electric charge is built into the microphone, and due to this high resistance, it has so good chemical stability that it will not decay for hundreds of years. A typical electric microphone contains a preamp, which is a FET, and has a very much common sort of configuration. It has a two-terminal electric capsule that contains the FET and must be externally powered by the power supply voltage, usually 1.5 volt, and there is a resistor in there that sets the gain of the output impedance. So the audio signal appears at the output after DC blocking capacitor. Now, there are roughly three major types of the electric microphones. One is foil type, of the diaphragm type. The other one is back electret, and the other one is front electret. Very interesting about the history of the electric microphone. It was known since 1920. It was proposed so many times. it wasn't used till 1962 when Bell Laboratories decided to use it. And there was, if I remember, Mr. Sessler and Mr. Jim West, and they applied a foil on the top of the Teflon. And to XGM. That became a most common type or used by many applications in high quality recording studios. Another comment would be that there are many types of condenser microphone, but some of them require no polarizing voltage, but I mean all of them, they do not require the polarizing voltage, but normally they contain integrated preamplifier that does not need it requires the amount of the energy, but people somehow incorrectly call it polarizing power or the bias. This preamp is known as Phantom, and is powered in sound reinforcement at studio applications. That would be all. Thank you very much.
As you can see, that very simple looking circuit has got a lot more going to it than first meets the eye. Robert Diamond Incorporated is a company that sells electronic products. I think they're located in the Valhalla area of New York State. The Robert Diamond catalog will show you a number of these electret microphones that you can buy for them at very inexpensive prices. When you buy that microphone, you're getting what looks like a microphone element, a tiny little element, but built into it, as Eric Wesley was just telling us, is the transistor that is the first preamplifier that impedance matches that thing to the outside world. The actual electret microphone itself, the real thing that's converting audio sound pressure into voltage, has an output impedance, in some cases, 10 million ohms, and so the preamplifying transistor is built into the microphone, and so you think you're buying a microphone element. You're buying a chunk of electronics that then is made to match the rest of the electronics that's in the radio. So to bypass all that circuitry and plug in the audio by external means, as you can tell, there's a lot more that meets the eye. Obviously, Robert, K4 NBC, has run into that headlong, and he's in the process of solving that. When it comes to moon bounce information, let me drop. I found the website that if you go to this website, you'll see the archive of all the past issues of the 432 and above EME news by Dr. Alan Katz, K-T-U-I-H, and you start reading some of those issues. If you're really interested in moon bounce, and you start reading either the most recent issue or the issue 10 years, 20 years, 30 years ago, you'll see the progression of that technology. And those people, these very enthusiastic people, you know, 4 of them per million in the general population, the progress that they've made in super high gain, aimable amplifiers, electronically steerable, mechanically steerable, super low noise amplifiers, super high power output transmitters, power supplies, protocols, and whatever. These guys have been at it for a good fraction of a lifetime. Some people think that that's the only kind of real ham radio. And they appear in this journal that you can get for free of charge, and you can look at these archives by going to www.nighthawk.com. That's nighthawk.com/Rasmit. I'll spell that. RASMIT. Another slash. Echo Mike 70 Charlie Mike .html. So the whole website is www.nighthawk.com RASMIT / by the way, enter the com / RASMIT / Echo Mike 70 CM .html. You go to that website and you'll find 30 years of monthly journals of information on the subject of moon bounce. It is a lifetime of information. If you want to know state-of-the-art, high power, high sensitivity, high gain, transmitting and receiving systems, those guys have been doing it with a passion.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Those guys have been doing it with a passion for 30 solid years. In fact, Alan Katz, I went to his honorary dinner a couple of years ago in which he was giving IEEE Fellow Award, which is the highest award you can get for the IEEE, and part of his award was given because of what he's done with this journal that he's been publishing for 30 or 40 years. And he is Mr. Moonbound. He is the guy who is the major organizer of all these Moonbound get-togethers that are happening once every 2 years in various places around the world. Okay, John, I think you had one more you wanted to go to. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, I'm going to forego my time for Wesley because I know he needs the time.
Okay, we're going to be cut off at midnight. Bernie is getting the information if you need it, and looks like we're going to go into the that particular deeper stuff tonight for what Wesley has been pursuing. N2XJN. Go right ahead, Wes. K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN, thank you very much. The information about the subject discussed were essential, so the people interested with that can look at that. Recently, I was lucky enough to buy for pennies three Ketco, which is located in Brooklyn, a power supply amplifier, and they are bipolar power supply amplifiers. And some of them are being called OPS series, and some of them POP series. What is amazing in this device is they could drive capacitive loads and inductive loads. So the series of BOP is suitable for a wide variety of applications such as solar cell panel testing, driving and testing piezoelectric devices, capacitor testing, driving and testing capacitive transducers, and power for the industrial lab application, which has capacitive or capacitive resistive loads. The inductive loads there are models called BOP, and they are optimized for driving those loads. This option makes the BOP suitable for motor testing, magnetic components, coils, speakers, industrial application with inductive loads, driving CRT coils, cryogenics application, and powering, correcting magnets for the medical imaging application, so that would be nuclear magnetic resonance, or even particle accelerators. I believe we're touching the subject that was not discussed on the TechNet as of yet. It looks like a very weird power supply, although it is able to mimic a input signal of AC, which would be sine wave, square wave, ramp, source, and any exactly to the frequency, depends for the model, up to 500 kilohertz, which is very interesting. Now, I have a first link that we would like to go to, if you want me to, and that is OPS series.
Yeah, I'm going to put in a couple of words here to try to explain from my point of view. I went to your purchase, let's see now, I guess it was the email you mailed me a few days ago, in which you showed about the purchase of these KEPCO power supplies. What's unique about these KEPCO power supplies is they're called four-quadrant power supply. In other words, when it puts out a positive voltage, it's expecting a ordinary positive current. You also can make it put out a negative voltage. It's a bipolar power supply. It's really a great big high power op amp. You give it a command voltage that's positive or negative, it gives you a output voltage that's positive or negative, that's either 10 times bigger or 100 times bigger, and various of these KEPCO power supplies will go as high as plus and minus 1,000 volts. Let me drop. So when this power supply is being commanded to get out a positive voltage, it expects ordinary positive current to be the load on the power supply. And when it puts out a negative voltage, it expects a negative current to be put out by the power supply or by the load. However, there are times when a power supply puts out a positive voltage, it expects a positive current, but the load, which is active, supplies a negative current. That's the upper left-hand corner of the four quadrants, and vice versa for the lower right-hand corner. In other words, if I'm using this KEPCO power supply to test an active circuit like solar cells, I've got a very peculiar voltage current characteristic. If you put various loads on solar cells when they're being hit with a high noon light from the sun, at first the voltage, if it's a 24 volt output set of solar cells, at first it continues to put out 24 volts as you put a lower and lower load resistor on it. All of a sudden you hit a critical load resistor and the thing drops like a rock in voltage output. It goes from a nearly constant voltage supply to a nearly constant current supply. So if you're trying to find out your particular solar cells, what's the ideal loading for them, you're building electronics for your solar cell power supply system to charge your batteries, and you want to find out what's the optimum load, the optimum power output, you have to trace this very exotic curve that the solar cells put out. In the last month or two of QST Magazine, there was an article about solar cell power supplies, and they showed you that curve. I think it was in one of the technical discussion sections of QST. So in the last month or 2 months, this solar cell crazy characteristic was described. This KEPCO power supply that Wesley has bought a couple of for feeding his circuit has this other application where to test solar cells, it can do a beep
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
To test solar cells and other kinds of power supplies, it does a beautiful job. Another place where you would need this is to test the screen grid voltage power supply circuit for a high power moon bounce transmitter. It turns out the screen grid of a tetrode tube under certain load conditions, even though you think you're putting 300 volts on the screen grid and you think it's going to draw positive current, under certain load conditions, the screen grid of your cathode, of your tetrode power tube, like a 4CX250B, will pump current back into the power supply, and if the power supply is not adjusted, is not designed concurrently to accept that, to accommodate that, the problem is that your diode rectifier network of your 300-volt power supply becomes back-biased. The current being supplied by the screen grid of the tetrode tube will suddenly make that screen grid voltage that was designed to be 300 volts, it go to 5, 6, 700 volts, it'll climb to some extremely high number, way beyond the ratings for that particular tube. You raise the screen grid voltage that high, all of a sudden the tube that normally draws a quarter of an ampere starts drawing 2 amperes, and it blows all the fuses in your circuit, and you think your circuit has gone into oscillation. It's really just bias runaway. That KEPCO power supply that Wesley has could test for that condition and make your moon bounce transmitter a lot safer. You'll be amazed how many guys have gotten extremely frustrated where the high power amplifier starts behaving in these peculiar manners because they didn't have the right bleeder resistor on the screen grid power supply. They didn't understand this phenomenon. It goes into this bias runaway condition, keeps cutting itself off and blowing fuses and whatever, and until they can find out what's causing it, a very simple bleeding resistor, once you understand the problem, fixes it. So you'd be amazed the kind of testing you can do with a four-quadrant voltage variable power supply, and that's what Wesley has bought.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The majority of electronic engineers do not understand this very exotic circuit, very useful circuit. Therefore, he's able to buy them for very cheap prices because people don't know how valuable they are. And in some cases, he's even able to buy one that's not in working condition. As long as 95% of the parts are there, it's not too difficult to fix one of these things. So I think you bought either two or three of them. I'm not sure if one of them was in working order or if all of them are in working order. Back to you, Wes, but you bought a very exotic circuit that very few people know about that's very useful. N2XJN, K2RIW in the deck nest.
Yeah, if you lock N2XJN, You can acquire one of them for $80. Now, most of the situation